This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. If you're like me, I avoid parenting books. Everyone has advice, and it can get pretty tedious hearing what's right and what's wrong. But have you ever wondered why we've embraced certain parenting techniques in this country? There are so many ways to raise a child. Coming up, we talk with NPR's Michaeline Duclef, lead reporter for its new series, How to Raise a Human. That's later. Also, we keep hearing the economy has improved. Improvements in the housing market are one sign of economic gains, but that's not what's happening throughout Connecticut. We'll talk with Hartford Current reporter Ken Goslin to find out more and speak with a longtime realtor about the trends she's seen post-recession. But first, were you hoping for a clearer picture of what candidates have emerged as top contenders in the August primaries, both in the governor's race and other state positions? As we learned last weekend, many Republicans are still interested in the governor's race, even if they did not garner at least 15% of the delegate vote. And some are collecting signatures to petition their way onto the ballot. And this past weekend, Democratic delegates chose their candidates. Were there any surprises? To help break it down for us, in studio now is Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also here with us, Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science in Hillier College at the University of Hartford. Nice to see you, Bilal.
Nice to see you also.
So I'll start with you, Mark. You've been covering conventions for many years. Any surprises this past weekend?
Yes. The fact that we're probably about to have a discussion about Lieutenant Governor, that's a big surprise. The surprise at the Democratic convention is that a young woman named Eva Bermudez Zimmerman, who's been campaigning for, well, who has declared her candidacy for 3 days before the convention, that she was able to pretty much embarrass her party's presumptive nominee, Ned Lamont, and his choice of Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicewicz by getting 40% of the vote, which became something of a protest, of an expression of discontent by elements of the party with Ned's choice, as opposed to simply people rallying around Eva Bermudez Zimmerman as a candidate. I mean, she's very much, I think, a symbol at this point. But yes, that was the surprise, certainly over the weekend in Hartford.
Oh, you were talking about people rallying around Eva because she had even said at the convention that she is one of the first Hispanic candidates to make it to the primaries, interested in a constitutional office. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes. The Latino community in Connecticut is really been slow to assert itself politically. It was only a few years ago that there was the first Hispanic Democrat elected to the state Senate. Andres Ayala. And currently there's Art Linares, who's a Republican of Cuban descent, who's in the Senate and running for statewide office, as it turns out, as well. But it's a growing population that has been slow to assert itself politically, as opposed to the black community, which is, you know, very much well-established politically, is for years, for decades, has been an important part of the Democratic coalition in Connecticut.
Ned Lamont easily getting the endorsement for the governor's race just a few days prior, him cutting a deal with Susan Bicewicz to be his choice for lieutenant governor. That way she would drop out and he wouldn't have to deal with running against her in the primary?
Yeah, it's a page from a conventional playbook in kind of an unconventional time. It certainly eased his mind about the primary. Instead of having a three- or four-way primary, he's really facing now Joe Ganim, who was pretty much snubbed at the convention. You know, Joe Ganim is the mayor of Bridgeport. He's a skilled politician as far as campaigning, but he obviously has a huge burden in that he served 7 years in prison for a public corruption conviction, and there is a lot of doubt outside of his close circle as to whether he could be credible statewide, certainly in a general, if perhaps he could win some support in a primary. So Ned Lamont decided he was going to simplify things. He had made offers to other people for lieutenant governor. You know, primarily, I know the one he really wanted was the New Haven mayor, Tony Harp, which would have been smart politics as well as getting a good partner for governing. Having an African-American woman who's a mayor of New Haven, a major base. It's the largest source of votes for Democrats. And she's also a woman who was the appropriation co-chair for years before she was elected mayor. So had she joined the ticket and had they been elected, she would have been a player at the Capitol in a way that a lot of lieutenant governors aren't.
Bilal Sakhu is also here in studio with us. Mark had talked about some of the tension because of the choice of Ned Lamont to pick a white woman, Susan Bicewicz, to potentially be his running mate if she wins now in the August primary. What's your take on that tension within the Democratic Party seeking a more diverse ticket?
I think in some ways this what's playing out in the state of Connecticut is similar to what's playing out at the national level. The Democratic Party at the national level relies on the votes of people of color in many ways to win the presidency. The Democrats absolutely need a turnout among people of color, not just a ordinary turnout, but we are increasingly seeing a high and extraordinary turnout. I think here in the state of Connecticut, you see a similar situation where turnout in central cities, places like Hartford, places like New Haven, places like Bridgeport, is key to the Democrats winning. And so for African Americans, and I think Paz is right, that certainly there are have been more entrenched in politics in the state than the Latino community has been, but it's been focused primarily in urban areas. And I think right now people are saying to themselves that they'd like to see someone near the top of the ticket, if not at the top of the ticket, who is a person of color, particularly given how dependent the party is on those votes and for that support. And I think this race will probably be a very close gubernatorial race in November, which will attract a lot of attention from outside of the state, money coming into the state, some of that dark money. And I think the Democrats will need an exuberant turnout. And this raises questions about whether that enthusiasm will be there if the party doesn't really address this issue.
This is Where We Live. I'm getting a recap of the State Democratic Convention. In studio with us, Bilal Sakhu, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. Also with us, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Mark Pazniokas. What's your response to what Bilal was saying, Mark, but also looking at some of the other races for AG and Treasurer? We are seeing some diversity.
No, that's true. Overall, it's potentially a very diverse ticket. The candidate endorsed for Attorney General would be the first Asian elected statewide in Connecticut.
William Tong.
And in the race for Treasurer, the endorsed candidate is Sean Wooden, who's an African American lawyer with a background in finance. He is the endorsed candidate, and he faces a three-way primary with an Indian woman named Dita Bhargava, and then there's everybody was just at the convention saying Arunan Arampalam, and he also is a lawyer with background in public finance. He is born in Zimbabwe of Sri Lankan parents, so you know there's certainly diversity, but sort of by political standards of Connecticut, non-conventional diversity. The thing you have to remember, there's a long tradition in Connecticut of ticket balancing by the Democrats, going back to 1962 when John Bailey, the great ticket balancer, helped put a banker named Gerald Lamb on the ticket. He was the first black person elected statewide in Connecticut. He was the first black state treasurer in the country. And it started this string of, in every election since then, there has been a black candidate nominated by the Democrats for that position. There's good in that, but the bad in that, it sort of became a set aside in some ways. And it's produced a diverse ticket time after time, but it sort of has become autopilot. And there's been resentment about that. It's like, okay, this is the one seat. So that's part of the debate this year. Now, the other thing to quickly throw out, in the age of direct primaries, you really can't pick a ticket like that. Ned Lamont certainly is the presumptive nominee for governor, could name a running mate. But as far as the rest of the down ballot, these are individual races, and people have to rise and fall on their own.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Talking again about that lieutenant governor Democratic primary where you have Susan Bicewicz, who is a longtime political person here in the state of Connecticut, against this newcomer, Eva Bermudez-Zimmerman. What do you think is going to happen in August in terms of the fact that we have this primary in the middle of summer, but there's also a lot of interest with this newcomer and this race against the established establishment. Do you think voters are going to come out to the polls, Bilal? Yeah.
It'll be interesting because I think in Eva's case, she has gotten a lot of support from labor. She comes out of labor, and the Democratic Party needs labor in order to be able to win. And so in some ways, this protest vote, to me, reflects some of that tension between Lamont's choice of Bicewicz as lieutenant governor, their feelings about her and her support for labor kinds of issues, and having one of their own in addition to the diversity issue. And so I think, you know, the potential for this to be a very heated lieutenant governor's race is real, because I think that there are lots of folks in the labor movement. The labor movement itself is increasingly growing with people of color in the ranks in terms of the areas where labor has been able to really do some effective organizing in recent years. And so you see that tension bubbling up also within the labor movement and questions about leadership among the various unions. And so Eva really represents the face of labor in the future. And so in that sense, this is going to be a very interesting summer to watch this race unfold.
Mark, what will we see in the next few weeks?
Well, we'll see the primary situation clarified, because there's a deadline at the end of the week about people who are going, who are at least going to accept the qualification and go forward with the primary. And that's more of a question with a couple of Republicans. We won't know the full primary ballot until the middle of June. The deadline for people petitioning is June 12th. And then it takes days for these local officials to authenticate the signatures. So I think you'll start to see some, I think there may be a down day or two as people regroup, but you're going to see some visibility events. Bilal is absolutely right. Eva's strength is the labor movement. You will start to see events staged by them. The other thing I think to keep in mind is that, you know, the labor movement and the black community, there's something in common there, which is from time to time they feel that they're taken for granted by Democrats. So, you know, these things will come together in her campaign. I mean, she's Puerto Rican, she's not black, but there is that sense of the Democrats from time to time taking those groups for granted. So that I think will be part of the energy we'll see there. We're not going to see a lot of issue differences between Susan Bicewicz and Eva Bermudez Zimmerman. I mean, let's be honest. This is not going to be a great campaign about issues. I'm guessing they're going to agree on 99% of the Democratic agenda. The question is, what will it say regarding who the party puts forward? Now, the irony is, a month ago, people would have said, in the year of the woman, having Susan Bicewicz step forward and being on the ticket probably would have been a great thing. But this has been something that has really been organic. It just blew up.
Wow.
I think in some ways, though, this goes back to my earlier point. I mean, I think that this is a much larger issue and a much larger problem for the Democratic Party. This is a party that increasingly relies upon people of color in order to win. And so people of color are saying, we want to be more than just this group that you call upon every 4 years to get elected to office, and that we want representation. I mean, I think it plays out. You look at the delegation for the congressional delegation in the state. You look at the state the leadership in the state legislature. You look at the leadership that the Democratic Party has put forth for statewide offices. And what you have is quite a conundrum. You have a party that probably, I would say, 30-40% of the party's sort of core base of supporters who turn out regularly are people of color. And yet the people who run the party, the people who are the leaders of the party at the state level as well as in the legislature, are not reflected with the groups that are crucial to the success of the party.
You mentioned the congressional delegation. You know, we didn't even talk about the what happened in the 5th District, Mark, from the Connecticut Mirror, Mark Pazniokas, in terms of another newcomer, Johanna Hayes, an African-American woman, a National Teacher of the Year, looking to seek the nomination, the endorsement, and she getting very close race with Mary Glassman, another longtime politician in the state of Connecticut. Tell us what happened there.
Well, there's an example of a leader of the party, namely Chris Murphy, really reaching out to her and encouraging her to run because he recognized what Bilal just said. And it's not just the qualifications of the candidate for the position. It's what the candidate would do by being on the ticket, who they could help turn out. And not only do they think she is ready to step onto that national stage, but that she could turn out people, excite people in communities in the 5th District, you know, Danbury, Meriden, New Britain, where there are decent-sized minority populations. And what it would say more broadly, you know, again, a little bit of excitement, a fresh face. So what happened there that night was she and Mary Glassman were neck and neck. At the end of the second ballot, it looked like Johanna Hayes was going to win by one vote. There were vote switches, which is part and parcel of the rules and the culture of both parties. And Mary Glassman pulled it out. And one of the factors seemed to be some resentment expressed towards Senator Murphy for not making the right phone calls, not reaching out to people to explain what he was doing. And again, it sounds petty, but that's also part of politics.
How much does this have to do with the Trump effect, so to speak, getting people energized to not only seek office, but to come out for the elections in November?
Donald Trump is the Democrats' best recruiter at this point. He has been since election night in 2016. We've seen that in the municipal elections. We've seen it in election, special elections elsewhere. And it's the best thing the Democrats have going, because the trend in Connecticut, at least for the General Assembly, was a strong Republican trend. You know, they were on the verge of taking over the General Assembly. They tied in the Senate. They're only 5 seats short in the House. Now it's a jump ball because the Democratic base is certainly energized by President Trump.
Yeah. It's a big question mark for me about what will happen between now and November, and to what extent here in Connecticut the Trump effect will have that kind of effect. I think, you know, certainly nationally what we've seen is that Donald Trump has been someone who has motivated especially people of color to turn out to vote in places like Alabama and other states that have held primaries that Democrats have had some success in. And so on the one hand, I think there's a real potential for that effect to occur and that it will sort of galvanize turnout. I mean, the challenge, of course, is that when you have a primary on August 14th, a lot of people are out of the state. A lot of people are not around for the primary. So we may not see that kind of a jump like we've seen in other states. But then there's a lot of time between now and November and a lot of things that this president can do to energize the base. And, you know, his regular Twitter rants and other sort of efforts to polarize the population may, in fact, boost turnout in November. And the Democrats will probably need that, because Mark is right that the trend over the last few election cycles have really favored the Republicans. And Republicans feel like they have a good shot at winning the governorship and taking control at least of one of the chambers in the House, the state House. The state legislature. And so from that standpoint, I imagine they're going to be quite energized. And I think the other thing will happen, this governor's race is one of those positions that nationally the Republican Party thinks that the Democrats are vulnerable in the state, and there's a possibility of actually winning the governorship. And so from that standpoint, we're likely to see a lot of interest in the state, a lot of visits by people coming into the state. And what will be interesting to see is if Trump is one of those folks who will try to visit the state to sort of rally his base in the state.
Mark, do you think that'll happen?
Before a primary, there are certain people who I think wouldn't have minded that. In the general, I'm not sure if he'd be a help or a hindrance in this state. And, you know, it was the same question with Dan Malloy. How visible do you want Dan Malloy in the fall for the Democratic ticket?
And before we head to break, there also are independent candidates running for governor. We should let our listeners know about them, Mark.
Oz Griebel is probably the best known former head of the Metro Hartford Alliance. He was a candidate for governor for the Republicans in 2010. He's trying to sort of find a middle path between the two parties. I think his best hope would have been if both parties ended up with extreme candidates. And on the Republican side, I mean, there was a fear that Peter LaMage, who was very conservative, strongly identified himself as a loyalist to the president, but he didn't qualify for primary and he's not petitioning. On the Democratic side, the nightmare scenario for them would be that Joe Ganim somehow would win. with it being a two-way primary, if there is a primary, or at most a three-way. There's a gentleman named Guy Smith who's also petitioning to get on the Democratic primary. You know, that seems to be unlikely. And there's also, there are minor parties as well. The Libertarians are putting somebody forward. I think the Greens are going to try again. And there's an independent party, which the control of that line is now subject to a court fight. So it's unclear at this point if whether or not they'll have that ballot line or not, because it's up to a judge to figure out who controls that line. 2 years ago, nobody had it in the Senate race because they couldn't figure out who controlled the line.
You've been at this a long time, Mark, as a political reporter in the state of Connecticut. Have you seen this level of interest in office?
Sure. As far as candidates, no. I mean, if you're talking about the fields for Democratic and Republican candidates, hell no. I mean, this was amazing. 11, 12 fairly credible candidates on the Republican side, credible as far as able to raise significant funds and get some support. On the Democratic side, at one point, they were up to 8 before, you know, if you include Luke Bronin, the mayor of Hartford, who was exploring. Yes, it's kind of the extreme case. It's an open seat, you know, so that does attract more. But the other dynamic is that it's a job that's still considered to be a pretty tough job to do, that the next governor, as is the case with the present governor, is going to be faced with significant financial challenges. Those are not fun times to be a governor. You know, you're saying no to people, you're cutting, you're looking for revenue. And so there were any number of people who you would think would have been interested who took a pass. So you had a field that was, I won't call it the B team, but they were, you know, not the more obvious candidate, shall we say.
Bilal, one tweet from a listener: if the Democrats think they can just run on "We're not Trump" and not the issues affecting Americans, they will have learned nothing from the disastrous past election.
Right.
In response,
I think the person who sent the tweet is absolutely right with regard to the congressional election. But just to follow up on something that Paz was saying, I think this gubernatorial race is a really important one, because I think Connecticut is at this point where there are some problems that the state faces that are difficult, and whoever steps into that office will have a difficult time, in addition to, you know, real structural fiscal budget problems that the state has in terms of generating revenue to deal with many of the challenges it faces. We've got infrastructure needs in the state. Our higher education institutions need money, need more support, and we've seen over the last few years that support has not been where it needs to be. We've got roads, we've got bridges, we've got, you know, a state in which affordability is an issue with regard to housing. You know, I teach at a university, and one of the things I want to do is encourage my students to stay here in Connecticut and to work and to live. But many of them talk and express frustrations about the employment opportunities in the state, express frustrations about opportunities to find affordable housing within the state. We've got fiscal strains at the local level, K-12 education, budgets at the local level. So the list sort of goes on and on and on. And I think whoever steps into this role the next time around has got to come with some really good ideas about how to move the state forward, because the challenges are real and they don't lend themselves to easy solutions.
We'll have to leave it there. Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science and Hilliard College at the University of Hartford. Thanks for coming in, Bilal.
Sure thing.
Also, Mark Pasniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks, Mark, for your analysis.
Always a pleasure.
And we'll be tweeting out some of Mark's stories at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, have you tried to sell your home recently or thinking about putting it on the market? Our next conversation is for you. We'll find out why sales are sluggish in some corners of the state, and we want to hear from you, too. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Spring is a hot market for home sales, or it used to be, depending on where you live. A recent Hartford Current report has found the housing market in Connecticut has not recovered to where it was in 2007, before the recession. Now, are you trying to sell your home? Are you looking to buy? We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Happy to welcome back to the studio Ken Gosselin, a reporter for the Hartford Current. Ken, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
So you recently wrote a piece with your colleague Matthew Kaufman about trends in Connecticut home prices. What's it looking like out there?
Well, we were wanted to see over the long term from the peak in prices in 2007 where we had come over the last decade, because, of course, Connecticut has had a very rough time and still continues to. And so we took data from 10 years, annual data, and looked at median sales price, which is a measure of how well prices are doing. And we were kind of surprised to find just how poorly we've been doing. We found that no county overall had recovered to where they were in 2007, and just 12 towns had done that. So it was quite an eye-opener. But we did kind of see a move towards recovery.
Now, we've done shows about what's working in Massachusetts versus Connecticut. So when we look at the region, how is it looking in terms of recovery based on what you're seeing in Connecticut? What's happening in Massachusetts, in New York, in Vermont, in New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're not seeing, I guess maybe to turn that around a little bit, what we're not seeing in Connecticut is the job growth. Okay, that is one problem that we're having. And, you know, we haven't even gotten back all the jobs we lost in the last recession, and we've actually kind of slipped back a little bit, so we're only up to 78%. So when you're not creating jobs, jobs are tied very closely to the housing market, and, you know, there's tentativeness there, you know, if there isn't job growth.
You interviewed a realtor, and she's on the phone with us right now, Joanne Breen, broker owner of ERA Sargis Breen, offices in Newington and Berlin, also regional vice president for the Connecticut Association of Realtors. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been doing this a long time. Again, we just heard Ken Gosselin saying that the housing market has not recovered to before the recession, but some areas are doing better than others. What can you tell us?
Well, yes, Ken is right. Ken and I have had many conversations over the years about the housing market. We are seeing certain towns, for instance, West Hartford's probably the prime example, where we're seeing prices coming up some. There's a little bit of appreciation that we can look to there. But overall, although sales are way up, number of sales are up, the prices are not back where they should be. We're not anywhere near where we should be at this point. And surrounding states have been appreciating for the last few years.
This is problematic. So when someone is putting their house on the market, you've put a lot of investment into your home. You're hoping to get some of that in return on investment. But the people looking to buy your home, they're not looking to give you that asking price. And there's a lot of negotiating that has to happen.
Yes. I mean, the only thing that's really helping us this spring, to be quite honest, is the inventory has stayed low. And because of that, we are seeing more houses getting asking price or even over with multiple offers, again, because the supply of houses is low. So that's a good thing, and I think that may be a sign that's helping turn the market around a little bit. But I think Ken hit on a key point. Without the support of a good, solid job market that's going to keep young people here in Connecticut, I don't think we can sustain the type of appreciation we used to see years ago. On an average, in a normal market, we'd see 5-6% appreciation a year. And if we see 2-3% in the hottest markets this year, I'll be thrilled.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Norm has climbed from Manchester. Norm, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a loan officer here in Manchester, Connecticut. And some of the things that we've been seeing in the market is that a lot of the people that bought their houses in, say, the 06, 07 crash and are now trying to get, you know, sell and upgrade, the problem is that the margin between what they can sell their house for and what they still owe on their mortgage is too small to take care of, you know, the real estate commissions, the upgrades that they have to do to the house when after an inspection from the new buyer, you know, whether it's upgrading an electrical or things that aren't meeting FHA guidelines or, you know, VA or USDA guidelines. So what we're seeing is some of those people are kind of stuck because they can't really sell their home right now because they don't have the equity enough to cover the expenses of actually what it takes to sell a home.
Thank you, Norm, for your call. Joanne, what happens when they get to that point where, again, they're hoping to sell, but then when you add up all of the commissions and conveyance taxes and fixing things after the inspections, do you see a lot of people that that drop out of trying to sell their home in the first place?
Well, I mean, as realtors, one of our jobs is to try to prevent having people even get that far into it without understanding what they're going to be facing. So when we go out to meet with people initially, those are the things we're looking at. I look at every house as a potential, especially in the lower price ranges, certainly, as a potential house for a VA or an FHA loan. And Norm is right. The restrictions on these loans as far as the repairs needed are very specific. So I look at each house expecting that if they're in that situation, I talk to the homeowner about what kinds of repairs they may have to make. And then on top of that, the market is so condition sensitive and has been for several years that today's buyers really want to walk in and find a home in HGTV condition, showroom shape. And not everybody's in a position to be able to afford the upgrades that will put it in that type of condition. So that may what it usually does is it prevents people from even putting it on the market because they realize that there just isn't enough money there for them to be able to get it sold.
Ken, what did you encounter in your reporting with the people that are looking for homes?
Exactly what, and Joanne's absolutely right about that. They're looking for, and I've been hearing this for more than a year, maybe 2 years, looking for those upgrades and looking for the new kitchen baths. And also, if you don't have that, that your house has to be priced at a certain level that the buyer coming in could maybe do that, but not just the amount to do that, but just to and have a little cushion, too, on top of that. So what your caller pointed out was absolutely correct, that, you know, at some point the numbers there just don't pencil out.
When you mentioned, Joanne, FHA or VA loans, these can be popular because they don't have to have as much down payment at time of closing?
That's right. For down payment for a VA, they can go for 100% financing. And for an FHA, all they need is 3.5% down payment. So this opens up the market to so many buyers who have the income to afford the monthly payment but just don't have enough down payment to go for a conventional loan. And then they can build their closing costs. Very often they're building their closing costs into the purchase as well so that they don't even have to have closing costs available.
Chris is calling from Manchester. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. So in Manchester, my neighborhood, I live in what most people consider starter homes, 1,000 to 1,500 square feet. And I've noticed that they seem to be moving an awful lot quicker than the middle and larger homes and, you know, middle to higher end homes in other towns. And also, same thing, my family lives in Windsor. Same thing there. We seem to notice that the starter homes value seem to be increasing quicker than the, you know, the 250, 350, which has always been considered kind of the prime market in Connecticut. Just wondering if they had any thoughts that's happening in other towns as well.
Chris, thanks for your call. Joanne.
Yes, I think Chris is right. It is something that we're seeing throughout all the towns. The starter homes are really the ones that are moving the fastest, and they're getting close to asking price because, again, the inventory is low, and there are many buyers out there who fortunately have decided that renting is not necessarily something they want to do for the long term, and they're seeing the value in owning a home again. So we're hopeful that this change in mentality is going to help us bring this market back in Connecticut.
Speaking of renting, I got a tweet from a listener, Ben, who writes, if we constantly expect rising home prices, we make income inequality worse because lower income people can't buy homes. I mean, what's your response to that, Joanne? Because we hear so often about the affordability housing crisis in the state.
Yeah, I mean, that I think is something that's always been with us and unfortunately probably always will be. But I am seeing a hopeful sign among the lenders. The lenders tend to be loosening up on their qualifications. I hope they never go back to the looseness of 2006 and 2007 because that's what brought us into this mess to begin with. But they are loosening up in a more reasonable way to allow people with lower incomes who have reasonably good credit and have a good history of paying on time to be able to get into houses. So hopefully there will be more first-time buyer programs coming along that will help people out and help them get into the housing market.
We were talking about the lack of job recovery in the state. Also, personal income has stalled. Growth has stalled in Connecticut. Lots of different factors leading to what we're seeing in the state. But I'm curious from the policy standpoint, when we look at what the state legislature and the governor, the policies they put in place, how is that either helping or hurting the situation, Ken?
I think that the uncertainty and the worry about, you know, budget deficits down the road, how that is going to then cascade down to the towns, what people will have to pay in property taxes. People may be able to afford the mortgage payment, but then the property taxes are high. They certainly are high. And if people on the flip side, if sellers cannot get the price that they want, but they're frustrated because their property taxes keep going up. So it is a very complex situation.
Joanne, I mentioned, besides being a broker and owner of ERA Sargis Breen, you're regional vice president for the Connecticut Association of Realtors. So what's your take on what's happening in Hartford and how that can help or hurt prospective home buyers?
Well, I've been very active with Connecticut Association. I've been up at the state, at the legislative office building, testifying either for or against various proposals that impact the housing market. Connecticut Association, our motto this year is give us a Connecticut to sell. And we are working very hard to support legislators who are pro-housing and working hard to keep bills from passing, like buyer conveyance taxes, for instance, that are just going to keep the housing market from recovering.
Explain briefly the conveyance tax for those of us who don't know a lot about it.
Well, the conveyance tax, of course, sellers already pay a conveyance tax, and we have for several years in Connecticut. When you sell a property, you pay a certain a percentage to the state of Connecticut, and then you pay something locally to your municipality. But now there have been proposals over the last few years because of the budget deficit for a buyer's conveyance tax. There are states that do have buyer's conveyance taxes, but in Connecticut, we are taxed for so many things. Income tax, our property taxes continue to go up. And now to add a buyer's conveyance tax on, there was a proposal by a few towns where they wanted to have the right to charge a buyer's conveyance tax and then use that money to purchase open space land. And right now, with the housing market still trying to recover, to me, to spend that money to purchase open space and charge buyers, it's going to end up being a cost, I think, in the end, to the seller anyway, that will get built into the purchase price of the house. And it will just keep the housing market from recovering as it should and appreciating.
Before we head to break, Ken, we were just talking about the results of the Democratic State Convention. Last week, we were talking about the Republican Convention. Any of these candidates talking about housing?
I have not really heard too much about this segment of the housing problem that we're the recovery, slow recovery. So I'm hoping that it will become an issue and that people will be talking about this and how all these things that are happening are playing into the housing market.
Ken Gosselin's a reporter for the Hartford Current. Ken, thank you so much. And we'll tweet out a link to your story at Where We Live.
Thank you.
Also, Joanne Breen, we appreciate your time, broker owner of ERA Sargis Breen with offices in Newington and Berlin. Thanks, Joanne.
Thanks for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. When you had kids, who did you turn to for advice? Your parents, your grandparents? How we raise our own children can be shaped by our family. A new NPR series looks at how different cultures raise kids. It's called How to Raise a Human. And coming up, we're going to speak to NPR's health correspondent, Michaeline Duclef, about the series, and we want to hear from you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. At the top of the show, I mentioned how I avoid parenting books. Do you as well? Everyone has advice, and it can get pretty tedious hearing what's right and what's wrong. But have you ever wondered why we've embraced certain parenting techniques in this country? There's so many ways to raise a child. It's the focus of a new NPR series called How to Raise a Human. Lead reporter in the series and global health correspondent for NPR, Michaeline Duclef, joins us now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Michaeline, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
So when I saw that you were doing this series, I was so excited. And tell us about the concept behind How to Raise a Human.
Yeah, so if you look at parenting books that we, you know, that are common in the U.S., you know, online advice, YouTube videos, almost all of this advice comes from the Western experience, Western culture, America, Europe, Australia. But we are just this little tiny, tiny sliver of humanity, especially throughout human history. And there's all these other cultures out there that are also raising little people. And so we were really curious, like, how they are doing it, especially these really old ancient cultures like hunter-gatherers and indigenous cultures like the Maya. So mm-hmm. we wanted to say, could we learn something from these other cultures and kind of fill in what's missing in the parenting books?
You mentioned the Mayan culture. Let's talk about one of the stories about the quote-unquote super mom and where you went to figure out why we're so stressed out in this country, but in other places, parenting, it's not such a big deal.
Yeah, so I spent about a week with some Mayan family in the Yucatan, and I was just blown away by how calm and relaxed the moms were. I mean, these women were working hard. They have like 4 or 5 kids. You know, they're taking care of livestock to help the family income. They're cooking fresh good meals every day. But they were just so relaxed, and their home was run with like minimal resistance. There was very little bickering, very little talking back. And I was like, how do they do this? What are they doing? What's their secret?
One of the secrets would be they have a lot of support. Familial support.
Absolutely. This is so key. So if you look around the world and throughout human history, kids just did not evolve to be raised by one or two people. There were a whole slew of people around them helping the mom. So the grandma is key, aunts, older siblings. And even in Western culture, we have a rich history of neighbors helping each other. This idea of just like a mom stuck in her home by herself, I call it a mom in a box, there to raise the kids is incredibly strange throughout human history, and even strange for Western culture. So, you know, we all know it, right? We all know that when we get our friends to help, we get our relatives to help, things are easier. And there's a reason for that. It's because kids evolved to be raised that way.
Now, you're also a mom. So there's so many different subjects and issues you can tackle in this series, How to Raise a Human. So how do you decide, you know, what to look into in terms of how all other cultures are dealing with the same issue?
Yeah, so we took like issues that were really like hot button issues in the U.S. right now. So baby sleep is a story that just came out today. That's, you know, you bring that up online and everyone gets heated up. And we're also looking at attention. So, you know, attention with kids, attention span with kids is really a critical topic. So we took these really hot button topics, controversial, with a lot of interest. And then we said, how are other cultures doing it? Can we get advice? Can we learn something from them? So we wanted to look at really meaty issues.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned bed sharing, the story that just aired this morning. In the story, you interviewed mother Melissa Nichols, who says she tried crib sleeping, so allowing her baby just to sleep in the crib, not with her in the bed. But she found it ineffective for her newborn baby. Let's hear the clip.
She was crying and like would absolutely not sleep. And I couldn't sleep either.
Because you wanted to touch her and hold her.
Yeah. And I also just kind of feel instinctually that, like, she should be on me. Like, she's been in me for 9 months. And, like, this has to be right.
So, Michaeline, again, this is very controversial. I know here in Connecticut, there were a few babies who were sleeping in the bed or on the sofa with a parent. And the babies, unfortunately, passed away. And so there was this campaign to say, you know, it's not safe to have your baby in bed with you. But that's something that a lot of parents struggle with. Tell us why.
Yeah, so this is a really controversial issue, and I just want to say up front, sleeping on a sofa with a baby is never safe. The scientific evidence is super clear there. But there's been this question of, like, for a mom that's sleeping in a bed that's, you know, safe, a firm mattress, no pillows, big comforters, you know, does this raise the risk of SIDS? Mm-hmm. If you look around the world and throughout human history, parents have been sleeping with babies for hundreds of thousands of years. Of course, the Western bed, the modern bed, is not designed for an infant in mind. You know, historically, babies have been sleeping on the floor or on very thin mats. So only in the last really couple of years have scientists been able to kind of tease apart, like, when you have a very safe situation, so the mom isn't smoking, the mom isn't drinking, the baby is healthy, not premature, full term and healthy weight, you know, is sharing a bed with a baby dangerous? Does it raise the risk of SIDS? And it turns out it's really not an easy question to answer. I actually spent like weeks tracking down the two people that did those studies because nobody else could really discuss the data with me. It is so complicated and so intricate. But I talked to them, and I also talked to the guy who interpreted the data for the American Academy of Pediatrics. And, you know, the bottom line is that there's very little evidence about whether it's dangerous or not in these non-hazardous situations. And if it is, it's a very small risk for babies that are healthy, full term, and the mom is, you know, not drinking, smoking, and really taking care. So it's one of those topics where it's like there's not like a black or white answer. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. It's hard for people, right? It's not just like it's always unsafe, it's always safe. There are particular instances where it is very unsafe. So the mom drinking, the mom smoking, being on a sofa. But there's other instances where it's relatively, you know, not gonna raise the risk very much, very, very little. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. You know, I'm speaking with Michaeline Duclef, global health correspondent for NPR Science Desk. We're talking with her about this new series, How to Raise a Human, the story that aired this morning. We'll tweet out a link about bed sharing and the risks associated with that if there are certain hazards in place, as you mentioned, and tracking down the authors of these two studies that came up with the conclusion based on these studies that babies older than 3 months, if there was no detectable increased risk of SIDS among families that practice bed sharing in the absence of other hazards. We're getting a tweet from a listener, Michaeline, who says that she's hearing a lot about cultures where help is offered by grandmothers, aunts, sisters. Mm. She wants to hear more about the involvement of men. And so that's my next question for you, is how you, what are some of the future stories you're going to be working on?
Yeah, so the men question is really interesting because really throughout human history, now not all cultures, like there are some cultures where men are quite involved, but typically men haven't been very involved in raising children. And that's where actually in Western culture, we see this movement, right, where the men have stepped up in the last generation or so and filled in for some of the parenting role that's missing now from the grandmother and the aunt and the sibling. So if you look, the average number of hours that men are now helping out as a parent with caretaking has doubled in the last like 50 or so years, but women are still doing more of the share by far. So the men are definitely stepping up and filling in for what we call alloparents or other parents. But the women they still need more help than that, I think.
I mentioned your series is How to Raise a Human, hashtag How to Raise a Human. So you must be getting a lot of response from listeners about the stories they want to hear. I'm interested in the consumerism that has taken over when it's time to have a baby in this country and all of the special things you need.
Well, I think that this speaks to this idea in our culture that, like, you need to do a lot of stuff to be a good parent. So heavy-handed parenting is a good thing, right? And also, if you don't do X before 6 months or a year or two, then you're going to somehow hurt the baby. This is kind of these, we need to do, which often then ties in with buy. But if you look around the world and throughout time, the opposite is often true. A lot of cultures think that kids can really do well with minimal interference and that you're actually doing harm to the kid when you're trying to like wrestle them and force them to do certain things. The kids actually can flourish when you're more hands off. And this is interesting because psychologists these days in Western culture are tying together a lack of autonomy and a lack of independence with some of the mental health issues we're seeing in kids and teenagers, like anxiety and depression. So maybe some of this heavy-handed parenting is doing harm at some level, and we can learn from the mind moms to just back off.
Well, again, I really appreciate hearing from Michaeline Duclef, global health correspondent for NPR Science Desk, lead reporter for this new series, How to Raise a Human, joining us today from the San Francisco Bureau based at KQED. And I know this series is running through the middle of June. We're looking forward to the rest of your stories and your team.
Thank you so much.
Today's show produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Carmen Baskoff and Carlos Mejia. Also, our technical producer, Kion Wolf. Learn more about the show at wmpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.